And away we go. Hour number two today on the early show here on WWGH Radio, Thursday, August the 29th, 2019, 16 minutes past the hour. And we have got a great guest this hour, a first-time visitor to this program, but I'm sure you have seen him on television and on other radio programs. He is a regular on the Bob and Tom Show. He has appeared on Huckabee, nationally televised program, and he's a great comedian, and we've been lucky enough on this program to be surrounded by so many great comedians over the years, from Dick Gregory to Gallagher to Shecky Green to Bill Macy to Phyllis Diller. So many have been on this program over the years, so it's a great pleasure to welcome to these microphones this hour, for the first time, but hopefully not the last, the man who is known as the funniest man in America, James Gregory. Mr. Gregory, how are you?
Well, I'm real good, and I wish you would just call me James.
Well, we will stick with that, James. How are you?
If you say Mr., it makes me feel old. I'm having a great day today, and I hope you are too.
I am having a great day. Do you like this time of year as we're on the cusp of fall?
Well, you know what I've learned as life goes on, that no matter what the season is, it's just great to be part of it. If I'm alive and above ground, I don't care if it's winter, summer, spring, or fall. I'm just glad to be part of it. But yes, I do enjoy the fall.
You know, James, when you're out there traveling, doing stand-up comedy, at this point in your life, is it still a big kick as it was when you started?
Oh, absolutely. Once I hit the stage, it's as if I'm 25 years old. You know, it's the greatest moment of my life, performing and being on stage and meeting the people. As the years go by, the travel sometimes can be very fatiguing. That's what we, in the business that I'm in, that's the hard part of the job, is the travel. The easy part is the show.
When you get up on stage, right before you go on, do you have any technique or maybe little idiosyncrasies that you have before you go on?
You know, I don't really. I think when I started my career, the first few years that I started, there was a kind of, you know, some anxiety, or you'd be nervous, or you'd have these rituals you go through, and you'd have a cross your finger, hope it works out good, and maybe wish you a rabbit's foot in your hand or something. But as the years have gone by, it's such a regular part of my life that I don't get nervous at all. I'm not apprehensive at all. And there's no ritual I go through. I just assume that it's going to be wonderful, and it usually is. And I've met so many wonderful people over the years. I've done so many shows and been in so many places that it's almost like visiting old friends to me.
Mm. Is there a certain part of the country, I guess, are there different parts of the country, maybe is a better way to ask it, where things will work in one place but not work in another?
You know, that's a question that people ask me occasionally. Here's what I've learned. I've been fortunate enough to visit and perform in 38 of the 50 states. And I've toured all of Canada at least twice over the years, from Nova Scotia on the east to the Banff Springs in the Alberta province of Canada. And I've had the pleasure and great experience to go overseas a few times. I've performed in Germany, Spain, and Italy, primarily to entertain the military. And as the years have gone by, I've learned that people basically are people. If it's funny, it's funny. Now, there are parts of the country where you have to change a word or two. I'll give you an example. I was born and raised in the South, you know. So we refer to a grocery cart as a buggy. Yeah. Like a buggy in a grocery cart, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And the first time I did a show in Buffalo, New York, many, many years ago, back in the 80s, I was doing a little joke about a buggy. And after the show, the guy that owned the place told me, he said, when you say buggy, the audience is visualizing a horse and buggy. You should say cart if you talking if it upset New York. You know, so little words like that are different, you know. But other than that, I think it's about the same.
You know, Stan...
In other words, what I'm saying is, if I'm doing a show in Oklahoma, I do not have to change that show if I did it 1 week earlier, let's just say, in the Carolinas. Or if I do a show in Utah, I can do that same show that I did in upstate New York. Maybe it's based on the type of show I do, but I don't really have to change the show based on the geography.
Is there anything in your show that you would not talk about?
Well, I try to stay away from politics. I make a deliberate point to stay away from that. I do a lot of things in my show in a comical way that might be considered social commentary sometimes. But in the years that I have been doing this, and I'm in my 37th year now, I have never used the word Democrat or Republican. I have never named an individual political. I've never mentioned the president's name or a senator's name or a congressman's name. So, and the reason I do that, that's just my own personal view, is I think people get enough of that on the 24-hour-a-day news anyway. So I think when people go to see a show, especially a comedy show, that is an hour or 2 hour of time in their life when they can escape from that. They get enough of that on television anyway. So I do stay away from the politics. I stay away from, I don't think it's important that the audience know my personal belief. But once again, I'm just reemphasizing here that that's my own personal opinion. I know there are a lot of great comedians out there who do make political comments, and they're very funny, and they're very good, and that fits their agenda. I just stay away from it.
Well, it's interesting because, as you say, there are so many comedians out there today who base their entire acts around politics, and even some who don't base the entire act but still bring it up from time to time. Is political humor funny to you?
You know, it depends. It can be. But I think sometimes, especially in the past few years, it seems like some of the comedians are not really trying to be funny. They're trying to get their point of view across, or they're trying to get you to agree with them, or vice versa. It's an agenda, you know. Because you're probably old enough to remember, as I am, that some years back, when they did the talk shows, for example, like a Johnny Carson was on the Tonight Show for a lot of years and so on. In their monologue, they would always do something very current. They would do something political. But it was done in a very lighthearted, political-friendly way. And they also did it on both sides, for example. They didn't have like a pro-Republican or pro-Democrat. It was just politics. And that was very good. And I think as the years went by, some of these talk shows today, it's almost become a political show instead of a variety show. And I think that's the difference.
What's very interesting to me is, and I mean, and this is no secret, is that Stephen Colbert, who a lot of people believe is a very funny comedian, his talk show is very political, and I think most people would say very one-sided politically.
Right.
But it's made him the number one show in network late night talk.
Yes,
and before that he wasn't.
Exactly.
And before, when you're talking about Johnny Carson, I think the theory was, well, you have to do both sides so you don't tick off anybody, so you can be number one.
Right.
So what do you think has changed that has allowed somebody to be number one by doing that?
You know, that's the I don't think there's a definitive answer to that. I really don't know. I just think that it's almost like, I don't want to use the word cult, like C-U-L-T, cult, but it's like the audience tends to be members of a cause? Are they the member of a an agenda? I mean, they're there for that message, so to speak. And I think used to, the audience was there just to laugh and enjoy themselves, and was not necessarily looking for a message that suited their own personal belief. So I think a lot of the audience, for example, Stephen Colbert, for example, I think his audience are his fans, for example, in other words, they kind of agree with everything he says, you know. And I'm not, I'm a big believer in the First Amendment. I'm not really critical of that. I mean, evidently he's very successful, and the network is happy with it, and the sponsors are happy. So, and there's money to be made. But I just don't think that really comes into the category of comedy. It may be funny from time to time, but it's really not a comedy show. And we used to think that we would look forward to, like, maybe the Johnny Carson show as a comedy show. That was a comedy late night show, you know, with a little bit of politics mixed in. And today it's completely reversed. It's become a political show with a little bit of comedy in the politics.
I think you might be right on that. The other day, I saw Jerry Seinfeld giving an interview in which he said, I think he was with Eddie Murphy, and he was talking about how there are more stand-up comics in the United States now than have ever been before. Why do you think that is?
I think it hadn't started in the 80s, what we call the comedy club era, you know. In the 80s, the comedy clubs around the country really boomed. I'll give you an example. I started my career in 1982. The Punchline was a comedy club in Atlanta, Georgia. And the Punchline in Atlanta, interestingly, was the first ever comedy club in the southeastern United States. And a lot of people may or may not know this, but prior to 1982, the only place, and this is very interesting, the only place that you could see live stand-up comedy would have been in Los Angeles, New York, Boston, Cleveland, or Chicago. Now, that's quite amazing. In other words, there was no such thing as live comedians, like, say, in Kentucky or the Carolinas or in Alabama or in Oklahoma. They did not exist. Well, the comedy clubs started opening up in all these cities around the country, so you could actually see live stand-up comedy. And a lot of people got a chance to begin their career there. And then since then, I think it just kind of boomed as far as the people were available to start their career. In other words, used to, if you wanted to start a career in comedy, you had to go to Los Angeles, you had to go to New York, or you had to go to Boston. And there's so many people now who started their career in their own hometown. And that's how come, I think, as years went by, they generated so many comedians around the country. And they're still going.
It's interesting. When you go to a comedy club, there are the headliners who get advertised on the marquee, and most of the time they come from out of state. Right. And then there are the local people who are there during the week, and sometimes right. Saturday and Sunday. What is the difference between the headliner and the local person?
Well, the locals at some point become a headliner if they stay with it long enough and get to be real good at what they do. But a headliner, like when I started Microbird, for example, all the headliners were flown in from other parts of the country. There was no such thing as a headliner from, say, Kentucky, or a headliner from, like, Louisiana. Early in my career, I'll give you an example, I started out as an MC, or what they call the local act. The format in the comedy club era was a three-man show. You had the opening act, you had the feature act, or the middle guy, and then you had the headliner. And the headliner was always flown in from around the country. In my early career, I had the opportunity to work with people like Jay Leno. I worked with Jerry Seinfeld, you know. And I worked with Tim Allen when Tim Allen, who later became a big star in Home Improvement and other shows. But when I first met him and worked with him, he was the feature act, you know. So if you go to any comedy club now, and there's not as many now as there used to be, but some of these legendary clubs that have been at the same location for like 35 years, like Zany's in Chicago and Zany's in Nashville, and then you have these clubs around the country that have been there for a lot of years. If you go into their lobby and you see the headshots or the photos of the people who used to work there, for example, they worked there before they became stars. There's a great comedy club in Lexington, Kentucky. It's been around for about 35 years, for example. And they have what they call a Hall of Fame in the lobby of all these comedians who used to go there on a regular basis. And names like Jerry Seinfeld, he went many, many times. Tim Allen went many, many times. And at that time, no one knew who Jerry Seinfeld was, you know. So it's kind of interesting how this business have really boomed with some people and had ended up being careers. Like, I never became like a television star myself. I'm not a household name worldwide, but I've been extremely successful in this business for a long, long time. So there's a lot of guys like me out there who do this. It is our career, is what we do, and we've been very successful, but we're not in the same category as a Jerry Seinfeld. There's very few in that category. So there's a wide variety of comedians around the country today. And Jerry Seinfeld is correct. I think prior to 1982, there might have been possibly 100 or 150 professional comedians in the whole country. And now, some people say it's 5,000, some people say it's 6,000. I heard Robert Klein say recently that there's only about 6,000 professional comedians in the United States. Now, when they say professional comedians, that don't mean what we call hobby comics, people who have regular jobs during the week, and then on the weekends they do comedy occasionally. Professional comedians means those comedians who do that full-time. It's the only job they have. Just as you might be an electrician, you might be a plumber, or you might be a professional anything. As far as professional comedians, there's about 6,000 of us, according to Robert Klein.
You know, it's interesting when we talk about people, and I think certainly Jerry Seinfeld, certainly Tim Allen, and there are other people in this category. They started out just like everybody else, on the bottom of the card, maybe an opener, maybe a feature performer, but they got their own television series. They became headliners.
Right.
Do people, and we don't, you know, obviously have to single out anybody, but do people change? Because one thing I notice when I've been to the comedy clubs, the opening act, you will usually find in the audience talking to anybody when the show is over.
Right.
The headliner sometimes never comes back, and if they do, it's maybe just 10 autographs, I've got 10 minutes, and I've got to go.
Right.
Are they like that backstage? Is that something that happens to you when you become the headliner?
Well, you know, I think each individual has a different philosophy about that. I'm one of those people who I always, always hang out after the show until the audience is completely gone. And I'm so proud of that track record that I have. There's always something, and I'm always in the lobby. If they want to see me and talk to me and get an autograph or take a selfie, or if they want to buy some of the stuff that I have, they can do so. But I have a philosophy that I do not leave the building until all the customers are gone. I'm there. Because I look at it as I'm running a business here. These are my customers. And I want those customers to come back and see me again. So I've always got time with any audience member. Now, there are some people who are the completely opposite. As soon as the show is over with, they want to get out of there. And I can't explain to you the difference between those two personalities, but I think everybody's just different, you know.
Is somebody who, you know, wants to get out of there right away, backstage when you're with them before the show, because the audience is not backstage, but the other comedians are they nice people? Do they have a little bit of an air about them that I'm the star and this is the way it is?
I think it works like in other areas of society, for example. The overwhelming majority of those guys are very nice, normal, down-home type people that you don't mind spending time with. And there's that small percentage, that 10 to 20%, that you really don't want to be around too long because they're not that likable, if that makes sense, you know. So, and that's been my experience. There's that small percentage that, for some reason, they either got a chip on the shoulder, or they have a bad attitude, or they may think they're better than the rest of us. But that is a small percentage. I think the overwhelming majority of people are just normal people to me. It's been my experience. And I've met a lot of them. I've worked with hundreds of them, you know. I've never been a part-time comedian. This is full-time to me. I've performed over 6,000 shows in my career. And with those 6,000 shows, there's either been one or two other comedians on that show with me. So that's a lot of people. And it's been my experience that most of them are just great people. And you have that small percentage who are just kind of jerks.
You know, it's an interesting thing because I've thought about this. There are places in cities across this country, small cities, small towns,
right,
where singers, solo acts, can go every Saturday night and they can sing in front of a group of people and people will show up.
Right.
Could a stand-up comic do that? Is there enough material to stay in the same place every Saturday night indefinitely?
I don't see how that can happen unless, of course, you are based in Las Vegas or something. There's two or three comedians, as you know, in Las Vegas, and they stay in Las Vegas. But you've got to understand, though, that each night or each week, the audience is different because those are usually tourists. But to do, for the same comedian to do a show weekly in his own hometown, I don't think would work.
When you go out on stage, how much, do you know what joke is next? Do you know how you're going to open? How much is in your mind ready to go? And is there any improvisation to it at all?
There's very little improvisation, but there is some, especially toward the end of the show when I kind of talk to the audience a little bit. But most of the show, in my mind, I know what I'm going to do, but it's not like regimented. In other words, it's not like absolute. I may do things on stage that I wasn't planning to do. The interesting thing about the business that we're in is this. Sometimes comedians will get overly concerned about the material they're doing. Like, I have two or three friends of mine who will go to a place and they want to make sure that they do a completely different show than they did, say, maybe a year ago, which I think is a mistake to do. Let's suppose, I'll give you an example. This coming, next week I'm doing a show in Kennesaw, Georgia, for example. That's a city right near Atlanta. And then 2 weeks after that, I'm going to do a show in Nashville, Tennessee. And then after that, I'm going to do a series of shows in the Carolinas. And then after that, I'm going to do some shows in Odessa, Texas. All right. Well, that may be the same show to me, It may be to me the same show, but to that audience, it's a new show to them. If I go to Odessa, Texas and do a show tonight, and then a week from now, I'm in the Carolinas and I did that same show, well, see, naturally, it's not the same audience. So to that audience, that's a fresh show. It's only the comedian in my mind that thinks it's boring. So I have to stay aware of that, you know.
Well, one interesting fact about you, James, is that you work clean.
Yes,
you,
I do.
You don't use the bad language. Right. Did you? Was that a conscious decision? Did that evolve? Why is that?
It kind of evolved. Now, of course, I've never had like a double X rated show or anything. But what happened was, as the comedy clubs started to decline, you may or may not know this, but in the 80s up until the early 90s, there was a total of 450 full-time comedy clubs in the United States. Now, just think about that. Now, full-time comedy clubs at that time, all the clubs were Tuesday through Sunday. You did 8 shows a week, all right? And there were 450 full-time comedy clubs. And now, it's estimated there's about 150 nationwide, all right? Well, as the comedy clubs started to decline, then I shifted my focus to theaters. I started promoting my own shows in theaters. And all the shows that I do now, except for 3 or 4 weeks a year, are in theaters, some small theaters, some large theaters. Well, see, theaters are different than a nightclub or a comedy club. There's no age restrictions in a theater. So if you do a show in a theater, it's very likely that you got Mr. and Mrs. Jones, they'll come to the show, and they may bring their 2 children, and that child may be 12 years old and, say, 16 years old. All right. So I was aware of that, and it was a good business decision, for one thing, to do the kind of show that did not deliberately make any part of the audience uncomfortable, you know. Like some languages would be appropriate for somebody who's 30, 35 years old, but that language would not be acceptable to a 12-year-old, you know. So I have a family-oriented type clientele. You know, when people come to my show, there's all ages there. It's not a large majority of children, but I may have somebody in my audience that's like 13 years old, all the way up to 70, 75 years old, you know. So to me, not only do I feel better about it, I think the audience feels better about it, and I also think that it expands my horizon. It gives me a broad base of customer. So there's any number of reasons to stay away from the bad language. And quite frankly, I don't really feel about it myself. I really don't. In other words, if I had a routine, I'm more of a storyteller than I am a joke teller anyway. I just learned as the years went by that if I told that exact same story without the curse word, it's just as funny as if I told the exact same story with a curse word. Yeah.
Well, it's interesting because one of the things that I have seen is that a lot of comedians who would get a special maybe on Comedy Central, a broadcast network, used to try to clean that up a little bit because there are certain words you can say on television and radio and
right.
certain words you can't. Now I've noticed, even though you still can't say that word, they just bleep it all the way through the show.
Right, and you know what they're saying.
And you know what they're saying. So why have so many of the newer comedians added that? Does it make people laugh, in your opinion? Does it make people...
I don't think it does, but I think the audience... I don't think it helps, but in the comedian's mind, the comedian thinks it helps. especially the younger guys, and I don't want to sound like an old guy here and ridicule the young guys, but I think it's just they think it's chic, or they think it's hip, or they think it helps, but I don't think it does.
It's just interesting to watch it now. For people who haven't seen you, are you more of a storyteller or a joke teller?
I'm more of a storyteller, I think. I hate to categorize myself, but I don't do it. I'm not a machine gun type comedian like set up punch, set up punch, set up punch. In other words, I may have a particular routine that I'm doing or a story that I'm telling. The story may be 3, 4, 5, or 6 minutes, but you don't have to wait till the end of the story to laugh. You're laughing as I'm telling the story. And then there's a big explosion at the end. But it's funny as I'm telling the story, you know. And I try to do the kind of humor that is relatable to the audience, that they can relate to, that's believable. In other words, I think 90% of everything I do is based on reality. But even all of it, even if it's something that I just made up, is at least it's believable. It's not bizarre. So that I think the audience can relate to that. I think some of the most common comments I get after the show, and they're talking to me in the lobby, a lot of the compliments I get, somebody may say to me, you know, they'll say, "That was so funny. You remind me so much of my uncle." Or they'll say, "You know what? What you told that story about so-and-so, that reminds me of a guy I work with." You know, "Oh, I know what you mean. I know what you mean. I did that same thing happen to me one time." You know, so those are great compliments. That means that whatever I'm doing, they can relate to what I'm doing, you know.
Were there people who you looked up to when you got into the business who made you laugh?
Oh, gosh. Well, I was in a unique situation than most comedians because when I was growing up, even as a young man in high school and so on, in my 20s, I never thought that I was going to be a comedian. It never occurred to me that someday I would be in the entertainment business. If not for that club opening in 82, I would not be in the business today. But I had always been a big fan of stand-up comedy, even before I ever thought that I would be one. Now, I'm a lot older than some of the people that's probably listening to us now. But when I was a kid in grammar school and in early high school, the comedy that I saw on television, as far as the TV shows, was comedians like Red Skelton and Jack Benny and Burns and Allen. Remember all those people?
Oh, yeah. Great people.
Oh, absolutely. And then a lot of people may not remember this, but the Ed Sullivan Show was on every Sunday for 24 years. Right? And my father and I used to love to watch the Ed Sullivan Show just to see the comedian. Ed Sullivan always had at least one comedian every Sunday. And those comedians were like Woody Allen, they were Alan King, Jackie Leonard, and guys like that. And so my dad, we would watch that, and after the comedian was over, we changed the channel. We watched the Ed Sullivan Show just to see the comedian. So my father enjoyed stand-up comedy, and I enjoyed stand-up comedy. So I have always just enjoyed those people. I can't name out one specifically, but I've just always had it's just been something that I've always liked to see, is any kind of comedy on television. And I still feel that way. And I'd rather watch comedy on television than any drama. There's a lot of great shows on television. But if you just give me a few minutes of stand-up comedy, I'm a happy guy. And one of the great things about modern technology now that we didn't have years ago is called YouTube. And I always encourage the young people, especially young comedians today, go on YouTube and look at some of those old shows, not necessarily the sitcoms, but those old variety shows, the Johnny Carson Show, the Tonight Show with Johnny Carson in the 70s and 80s, and all those young comedians that he introduced to that show, and how funny those guys were. So it's the same way when I was in high school and the Tonight Show was on. Then I would have a part-time job at a grocery store, and I'd come home late at night. I'd do my homework, and I'd turn on this old black and white television and watch the Tonight Show late at night, just hoping there'd be a comedian on there. So I think comedy is something that is beneficial to the human spirit, you know. I'm not saying that because I'm in the business, but people need to laugh. And anything that makes me laugh or makes me smile, I'm always very grateful for that person.
I think a lot of us could use a little more laughter in our lives nowadays. James, when you're doing a television show or a radio show or a talk show in general, and you know that they want you to be funny when you come on, how do you prepare for that?
I don't do a lot of preparation. I do very little television, by the way. I usually do local television. I did Huckabee recently and things like that. But in my mind, I know what I'm going to say, you know, because it's very limited. Like when I go on stage, my live performance, for example, it's always me in one opening act. And the opening act does about 15 minutes. Then I do about an hour 15 to an hour and a half. So I'm on stage about an hour and a half live. But when you do these quick things on television, all they want you to do is like 4 to 6 minutes. So you have to adjust very quickly, you know. You want to be funny and be quick, and you don't have a lot of time to stall. That's the difference.
Well, James, we have about 6 minutes left here in the broadcast this morning. Now, is there something that you can think of right now, story, joke, 6 minutes that would fill, that is just guaranteed funny, works everywhere?
Oh, God, there's so many, you know. That's something that I've talked about for years. It's a routine. I mention it all the time. I've always had this fear of flying, okay? And over the years, I never do any show anywhere without mentioning something about my fear of flying. It may be 1 minute's worth, or maybe 5 or 6 minutes worth, you know. And when you get into that, and you're known for that, somebody will meet me sometime at a grocery store, or they'll meet me in the public, and they'll say, "You haven't been on an airplane lately, have you?" They just know I don't fly. And I used to make this joke, and I still do, you know. I don't mind flying once a year just to catch you. Just to catch up on my drinking and my praying. And then, you remember some years ago when the plane that crashed into the Hudson River up in New York?
I do.
They made a movie about that, Captain Sully.
Yes.
You know? And I told people, I said, "Well, just watch the news." I remember this plane, this was a plane, a jumbo jet. This was a plane. Knocked out of the sky by some birds. It was birds, not a deer. Birds. And this is an actual quote from Captain Sully. This is an actual quote. "The moment I saw the birds coming, I knew there could be trouble." When's the last time a bird hit my car? To put me in my vehicle instead of our airplane.
That's funny.
It's like UFOs. I talk about UFOs all the time. I know a lot of people believe in UFOs. I just don't believe in UFOs. It's common sense to me. Yeah. If there was life on other planets, we'd send them some foreign aid by now.
Well, you know, it's an interesting thing, James, because those obviously are very funny jokes and very funny stories. How do you know something's going to work on the stage?
you don't know it until you do it. You have to do it on stage first. You might mention it to a friend. He may not have the opinion you have. And I've just learned as the years gone by, instead of, if I come up with new material, instead of giving that idea to a friend of mine, what do you think about this? How does this sound? Because they may not know, because they're not part of the audience anyway. So what I do, I take the new material and I blend that in the show. And that will let me know whether it's funny, and then you have to work on it more than just once, you know. And that lets me know whether it has potential or whether it's going to be funny or whether it's funny already. So all my new material is tested live in front of that audience, you know.
Has there ever been something that you just thought, boy, this is going to be great, this is funny, and went out there and got nothing?
You know, to be honest with you, I guess maybe I don't have that kind of confidence to absolutely know it's going to work. I think I suspect it's going to work. Because sometimes you can be fooled, you know, something you think is going to be funny and it's not, you know. So it's just a hit and miss, I think, in my mind, which is good because having great confidence, you have to have confidence to do what I do. But if you're overconfident, sometimes that's more devastating than being lack of confidence, you know. You can't just assume it's going to work, and you can't be overly confident, and I never am, you know.
James, we have about a minute and a half here left. What are the traits for anybody who would want to be a stand-up comedian, or just people who give public speeches and try to invoke comedy in them? What are the traits that you have to have to make that work on stage?
Well, you have to have the desire to do it. And you have to find the nearest place that has what they call an open mic night or an amateur night. You may or may not know this, but instead of interviewing me now, if you were interviewing Jerry Seinfeld now, or Jay Leno, or Chris Rock, any of those guys, and you ask them, how did you start your career? And they will all tell you it was amateur night. The first time they hit the stage, nobody got paid. It was amateur night or open mic night. It's the only way to do it. It's not like any other profession. You can't go to college and get a degree. You can't fill out an application and be hired. You have to start on amateur night. So if you want to hit that stage and see if you make somebody laugh, there's plenty of places around there that you can find in your local area. And just do that and try that. And maybe take your friends with you. Have them to give you some confidence. And give it a shot.
Just got to get up there and do it.
Get up there and do it.
Absolutely. The guest today has been James Gregory, the funniest man in America. Check him out online, funniestman.com. And if he's coming anywhere close to where you are, I'm sure you will want to go out and see James. And James, I know this is your first visit, but I hope you come back in the future.
I certainly would love to see you again and talk to you again. Maybe the next time we talk, I can tell you the story about the first time I met Neil Armstrong.
That would be good. We'll save that. We'll tuck that away for the next visit.
Let's do it.
Thank you, James.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. James Gregory, the funniest man in America. Coming up right after I'm off today, Charlie Evers has James Anderson from the Tall Grass Trail. We'll get filled in on all the information going on there. And then at 12:10 today, The Progressive Life with Glenn Coble. All kinds of interesting information. Stay tuned to WWGH Radio.
Just about didn't survive that. Oh, my goodness.
but we have to. We didn't. That's the question. You don't know it, evidently,
yeah.
Right?
I have a prize. I'm hungry.
Oh,
you're hungry?
Well,
there's donuts. There's a whole box of...
No.
There's orange juice. There's coffee.
I got a friend out.
There's
I bring her a
T-bone steak and...
Charlie, you know what you're going to get. Five fingers.
Well... We can give you a delivery to take out to your friend, and we have the question, so you don't know it, right? You don't know. But I wish people would give them a really big hint,
okay,
so they'll call
it. Let's see. It's not Sandusky.
Yes, it is.
Holy
Uh-oh.
Okay, you guys.
Is there a 7-second delay around here?
Oh, no. You're kidding.
No, you're right. Yeah.
She was.